This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, Guy.
Hello, Gary.
It was really nice to see you in person the other day in a rehearsal room.
That was amazing. It was amazing to see you and other people. It was also really nice to actually perform some sort of a show to an audience of two.
Yeah. And they were tested, obviously. Socially distant. No, we got together for, I routined a few of the songs for my new record with Guy. What a band. That was nice to play with other musicians.
It was fantastic. It was an absolute joy. So thank you for that.
We all need that. And we are getting some great responses on stuff, aren't we? The Beatles one was with Giles was cooking.
Yeah, we seem to have tapped into the huge sort of subculture of Beatles groups social media. Sorry, not Beatles groups, obviously.
Some of us are only two people, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
but that has been fantastic. And so we've got another rather encyclopedic one today, haven't we? It's someone who's kind of, there's no one he hasn't come across.
He's played with everybody. And you know what this guy has given to British music? And young bands still to this day, with whether his work on the Tube or, you know, later or whatever it might be. I mean,
he's a way of speaking.
He has a way of speaking. And he apparently has this enormous, enormous train set.
No, don't. Yes, that's
which I'm really looking forward to. Also, we've not had anyone on this show so far who's, well, I don't think he's got anything to do with prog for sure, but no one on this show who's got anything to do with Boogie Woogie.
That's very, very true. So I think you just actually gave away our guest there, so we actually don't need to introduce him.
It's Mr. Jules Holland. Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
There you are.
We're all in? Okay. So we're on the phone now, but that's all right. Is that working okay?
Yeah. Is that going to be boring for you, holding the phone?
No, not at all. If it's all right for you, I'm just going to shut the door. Hang on.
And if your lawyer calls at any time, he's going to come up as well.
Is that a Paul Simonon behind you?
It is. That's right. Ah, it's very well spotted.
Yes.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours, Jules.
Very nice to see you. Very nice to be here. Very nice to be there. Looking well.
Everyone we interview now has also got a parallel podcast. We're all living in podcast universes.
Well, that's right. I hope you'll be able to come and join me on mine. I think it's the way forward. I think the traditional ways of writing a thank you letter or watching the television of an evening of kind of slipping away when everybody's podding or doing something else.
When someone gives you a birthday present, you have to do a podcast to say thank you.
That's right, exactly. You gather around with your friends and you make a whole documentary about them on podding. I don't know where the pod bit came from. I quite like that sort of word podcast. It's kind of.
Yeah,
it was from the iPod age. Remember that?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
In the old days, people used to cast nasturtions, didn't they? Or aspersions? They cast pods.
That's right. And I thought that I always thought that was a flower. I thought it was a flower being thrown around, a bit like that person that for years when he was at school, he heard the expression, his grandfather said to him, "Knowledge is power," Francis Bacon. And he misheard it and thought was knowledge is power. France is bacon. And he went through his whole life thinking that was the case. And then he went to, when he was at school, they said, the English teacher would say, "Knowledge is power, France is bacon." And he'd say, "Yes, knowledge is power, but why Francis Bacon? And they'd say, well, it just is. Oh, yeah. And he sort of accepted it. And it wasn't until he was sort of, you know, sort of grown up that it sort of the whole thing, he realised that it wasn't Francis Bacon. It was Francis Bacon. But they're the sort of, that's the old world for you. Nowadays, you wouldn't have any of that.
Yeah. And that man became the greatest boogie-woogie player in the UK. Yeah.
That's right.
Apart from podcasting, how has this all been for you? I did feel sorry for you a bit because I thought, oh, I hope he hasn't got all of those 20-odd musicians still on wages throughout that whole year.
Around his house. Well, I think I'd be bankrupt if I was. Unfortunately, no, I think it's been very hard. It's been for all the musicians and, you know, the people in my orchestra of all different sorts of ages. So some of the older ones, it's like an enforced retirement. And I think a lot of people, I'm coming across a lot of people in different spheres who, when it first happened, after I thought, well, actually, this is after a year, it's like a trial of retirement. And I think we're just going to stop, you know, it's like a practice of retirement. And that's what we're going to do. But then there's a backlash against that. For a lot of people who thought they were going to retire, they sort of did the bit in the garden, redecorated the sort of spare room, whatever they were going to do, thatched their sort of television or whatever they were planning to do. They did it. And then they thought, I'm bored as bollocks now. And so I need to find something. I need to go back to work. And I'm never, ever going to think about retiring ever again. So
I did hear a rumor from someone who's always on the road, who's very, very successful, who apparently said to his family the other day, I'm actually really liking this, hanging out with you guys. You know, there is that element of...
What a weirdo. No wonder he's in music.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just desperate to get away from my three loud boys that have just, you know, taken over the house. It's like Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there, you know, it would be silly to say there aren't benefits. You know, you see the flowers in the garden and you sort of understand the season, but... And everything slows down and you live the life of a civilian much more, which is more routine. And of course, the point, I think, of a musician or an artist's life is it doesn't have the same routine that other, you know, there is a routine, but it's not the one that people that do regular jobs have, because you're out at all sort of times. You're eating late at night, you're traveling in and you're only in one place for a day. And that's the whole point of it. And all of that sort of changes. And so you're at home for a week and it's odd. I suppose, you know, it's a bit like being a merchant seaman or something and suddenly you're at home and no ship to go on and you sort of just get a bit mad, you know. But hopefully we don't all go down the pub like sort of Victorian sailors and get blind drunk on gin.
But then, because Jules, you're someone who's such an obsessive, well, I mean, you work all the time, but then and you love to tour. But then, for instance, you had later moved, didn't you, specifically so it could be nearer your home?
There was a rumor that...
Well, we fell for it. I'm telling you that now.
Good. That's what I like the idea. I like the idea that I would wield such great power within the sort of BBC. And then he was a bit bored going to church, so they moved St. Paul's Cathedral to get it a bit closer to him. But I think what we did do, one of the things that, of course, has come out of it is that you couldn't do the usual program because, you know, the studio fills up with a few hundred people in the audience. And then by the time you've got all the musicians and the technicians, that's like another sort of 75 people or whatever. So, you know, the restrictions wouldn't allow that. So we came up inadvertently through the pandemic threw up was a new format, which was getting one guest in with me. And at first it was one guest just on a Zoom screen. We weren't even in the room together, although now we're allowed to be in the room. Distance by a piano, which is apparently the regulation distance you have to be from somebody to avoid. Yeah,
they were designed during the Spanish flu originally, weren't they?
That's right. That's why the grand piano.
Is that a metric piano or an imperial piano?
They're imperial pianos, I think. You know, metric slightly smaller. But we came up with this new format where people look at the or pick their favourite artists from our vast archive, or they have a rummage through my archives. See what they can find, and then we discuss it. And because that's on a much smaller scale, we do it in my studios in Greenwich. So in that sort of way, there is some sort of element of that, which is quite sort of useful because we go in there, and that's quite it's a fun place to do it, you know. But I wouldn't have believed if you'd have said to me, you know, in my studios, it's where we rehearse with my big band, we record there, rehearse with the Hootenannies, we rehearse for our tours, make all our records. I used to do radio shows, whatever. We'd do all the stuff there. But if you'd have said, oh, you'll be doing laters there, I'd have said, absolutely unbelievable. But it's true. So I suppose in that sense, we've done them at my house, yeah.
And hopefully the plan is to get back to normal at some stage. This is what we all want, don't we? I mean, Guy and I were rehearsing while ago, just recently.
Last week.
And the thrill of it, just being in the same room with a bunch of musicians, listening to loud music that we were making ourselves.
But that's very optimistic. What were you rehearsing for?
Oh, it's my record, Jules. Can I just promote that for a second and just say it's my album?
But I know you've got a new record, but presumably you've recorded your record, right?
Yeah, no, it was really just to make the thing come alive, because I was out there promoting it and I'd never heard a whole band playing it. And I just felt like I didn't quite believe in it until I surrounded myself by some musicians. And of course, the other thing is to get on your show.
Yes, exactly. Well, hopefully once it all comes back, there's so much stuff. I mean, what really is awful, there's so many people that had great records out, in the past year, and it's all kind of, if you had something come out, it's all kind of gone. You know, it's really sort of frustrating. Mm. I mean, the only other positive side of it is that people are at home and therefore they've got more time to look at stuff, I suppose, you know, and they're on their screens all the time. You know, they're looking at Instagram, they're discovering things. But did you find it hard to record a record under these circumstances?
It was hard, but
a studio with a lot of people.
But there were a lot of out of work musicians, so I had the opportunity to find people that would normally be on the road that I could work. We did it remotely, not over a phone like we're doing with you. I mean, but we did it, we did it remotely over the internet, and I think it worked quite well. You know, I think all artists, they come up against forces of opposition and they'll just try and step to the left or the right and get around it, rather than just giving up. Like, we all went scurrying off and made podcasts or something. I mean, I've slightly had an issue with people exposing themselves too much musically from their living rooms. I really want to see people that I adore just suddenly getting out their acoustic guitars and doing acoustic versions. I don't know. Do you know what I mean, Guy?
I know, absolutely. But it was the same thing, because I did some of your album at home. And then the two fantastic days when we came into the studio, because I hate playing bass for someone at home, because it's like half the joy of playing is being in a room with people, making their day, bringing something to their track. And, even if it's a track you don't particularly like. And then, but if you're just on your own, you're just like, well, is this any good? Will that do?
Well, I think that's right. You feel like something's great, but you can't. But when you're with people, you can read much more what it's all about. Yeah. And also, when you play things live, you can see whether it's having an effect on people or not. So, yeah, I think it's if you can't do that, it's very hard they're inextricably linked, a live performing live and recording. And, Dr. John once said to me, he said, whether I'm doing a gig or whether I'm in a rehearsal room or whether I'm in a recording studio, or whether I'm in my dressing room playing or whether I'm at home playing, they build on each other to give you the overall picture, which is the music that comes out of us all, It's very hard with people, because a lot of musicians, you've been making a record, a lot of musicians, they just tour. That's their job. That's their work. And they're the ones that have been really.
But I would say there's one thing, for instance, this is where Later is a very particular beast, and it's a brilliant thing. One of the reasons I love doing your show, Jules, is because you're performing to your peers. You're standing there with five other bands watching you, which is kind of equal parts. If it's Paul Simon, it's terrifying. If it's kind of Elbow, it's like, check us out.
If it's The Fall.
So, and that's a really brilliant thing about your show, that thing of having, because with, musicians usually only on stage one at a time, but that thing of being surrounded by bands.
No, that's right. And that's exactly it. And that's also the thing that, of course, you don't get in with our best of archive selection show. But you do get that in a sense, because you see in the archive some of the people who have been, in the archive footage, you often see bands looking at one another, and that's kind of the highlight of it. But I think it's also difficult, like you've put a record out, and it's really difficult because everything's more difficult. You can't do a promotional gig for it. You can't kind of, any interviews you do can't be face-to-face. You can't have a big playback for the record. All the stuff that you want to do, you can't do. It's really, I think it's...
I mean, look at you know, Paul Weller or Taylor Swift. They just released them one album. They couldn't go on the road. They just released another album.
Yeah.
Two albums back to back.
Turned everyone into Prince, just churning out records.
Yeah.
I want to talk about your history. Obviously, we both want to talk about your history, but we... But what interests me the most is how a bloke who plays Boogie Woogie becomes so successful, because this is so niche. There aren't many. Yeah. No, it's. I think you are definitely in 36 episodes or whatever we've done, 37, you're our first Boogie Woogie player. Maybe you could clear up Boogie Woogie for people.
Yeah, first of all, I think you're right there. I mean, Boogie Woogie's been much better to me than it's been to anybody else historically. You know, a lot of I love the boogie, and it's not. You know, it's. Well, we'll get onto sort of what it is in a moment. But I mean, it really is historically, the exponents really. You know, they didn't do well out of it, which was pretty awful, really. And it's not. You know, it's not a career path I'd recommend to a lot of people. There are boogies everywhere, but I think the key is starting with the boogie and having a feel for it. So it's a broad thing. I think it was Van Morrison said to me. He said, you know, there were people having a boogie, which is like some sort of a improvised dance that might have the odd sexy bit to it. They were probably doing that in a field in Somerset in 1320, and they were probably doing it somewhere in Africa in 1100 or whatever. And in Brazil, you know, everybody has their own boogie. But that the feeling of it, that is the feeling, which might be also you see it perhaps in if you see a Bruegel painting of a country dance, you can see the people all sort of drunk, having their knees up. That you can see that's the same feeling as a boogie, and I think it got honed down. As recorded music came in the 1920s and 30s, with the from the blues and the African American blues music, I think the word boogie woogie itself is an African word. It's which expresses dance and amorous feelings, but the actual playing of it, I suppose, that once it gets on to the piano, some people say it started on the, you know, I think all music evolves from lots of things that have come before it. But they do say a lot of the boogie woogie comes from the logging camps in Texas. If you look at the...
Did not see that coming.
No. And there was a man called Dudlow Joe. Turk. What was his name? Turk. And he was so enormously fat, he wanted to play stride piano, where your left hand plays a note and then the chord, and it jumps up and down the piano.
Like Mrs. Mills.
Exactly. But his belly was so big that he couldn't get his hand across there. So he developed a repetitive left hand, which gave birth to the boogie-woogie flavour. That's one story, you know, that's one sort of element of it. But they say it was in the logging camps it would go around. And the important thing to remember is that the deforestation of America at the turn of the 20th century was vast. If you looked at a map, you know, half of America was forests in something like this in 1890, and by 1930, a tenth of America was forest, because all of it, the logging industry was huge. So in those camps, that's where the music is supposed to have gone around. And then, of course, it builds up where the African-American migrant musicians come up and they go to Chicago because they want to get a better jobs out of the countryside. It evolves there. And the feeling of it then carries on through rhythm and blues music, and then through like rock and roll music that then comes after that and like Chuck Berry and that Jerry Lee and all those sort of popular people of the 50s. The same feeling comes through.
Well, yeah,
and they still get elements of it when you hear sort of Led Zeppelin. So there's a little elements or ska music has elements. So there's a lot of crossing over stuff. But when you hear a bit of boogie woogie piano, when it's done well, it really has a sort of it still thrills me when it's done well. It's lovely.
So was it one sort of epiphanic moment when you heard?
Yes, I could say that it was.
He couldn't say it.
I couldn't say that. No, I'm not even quite sure what the word was I was looking for.
No, I think epiphanic moment is a very good way of putting it, yes. I came in, my uncle, who was not that much older than me, and when I was probably sort of 8, and he would have been aged maybe 16, 17, something like that. And my mother had a Sister Rosetta Tharpe record of Up Above My Head and had showed my uncle some Boogie Woogie piano. He was then playing it on my nan's piano in the front room of a little house in Greenwich. And I came in and heard it. And I thought, that's the best thing I've ever heard. It just made me filled with joy and made me sort of want to dance around with pleasure. So I said to him, well, how do you do that? And he showed me, and I was able, not particularly well, I don't suppose, to copy him by ear and just by hand. He showed me what he was doing. So I then played that obsessively for a long time. Had my uncle been, let's just say, Paderewski or Oscar Peterson or something like that, I might not be where I was today, because I might
Mrs. Mills.
Copy that. I don't know if I could do all that now, but yeah.
So I just want to fit, there were two things in there. One, I want to know how much the piano was in your family. But the other thing is just going back on what Boogie Woogie is. So it seemed to me that it's unlike the blues, which can often be in a minor chord, because it's still 12 bars, isn't it, normally, Boogie Woogie? It has that feel to it. But it's
But you get Lightning Hopkins, and it's like 9 bars and then 13 bars. And it's I suppose the boogie, you know, you get a boogie. It's a fast blues, certainly. And it's got a certain feel to it that when it's quite hard to describe, but when you know it, you know it. You know, it makes you want to dance, it makes you want to jump up, and it makes you, I think that's the important thing that musicians, every musician has to do, really, to become able to work. You need to be able to make people dance and cry and feel amorous. You know, if you get them to feel those things, then you're sort of on your way. And Boogie Woogie is definitely something that gets them all charged up. I learned that in the, you know, playing this 1930s, you know, like Chicago music in a pub in Greenwich when I was a teenager, everybody got up and went, "Oh, this is great." You could see it having that effect. So I think it's certainly a dance blues music.
And is it always in a major key? Always in a major key?
No, I think like that's blues, something like,
it's
like
the half and half.
It's like, it's, yeah, exactly. It's in both at the same time. I think that's the pleasure of it. There's a lot of blue notes in it, and there's not really, there's no, and like the blues, there's not really any rules to it. And historically, where it starts, in Chicago, it sort of goes mad because all those blues people went there in the 30s, and they used to have these things called house rent parties, where basically somebody would have a party in their flat. You'd get there were good piano players. You'd rent the piano player would turn up, and everybody would pay a few dollars to get into your flat, and they'd all get sort of off their nut, and you'd have a nice time of it. And there was a lot of piano players working there for that, but they were kind of really inventing this incredible art form and not really getting rewarded for it. And it wasn't until later that people went, wait a minute, they've latched onto something here, you know, they've sort of invented something new.
But what's interesting is how that was going to fit in to Squeeze.
Yeah, well, I suppose when Squeeze starts, myself and Glenn Tilbrook and Squeeze, we used to go and play in local pubs. We would bowl in. I mean, we weren't particularly great, as you know, we were just learning ourselves, but we would bowl into a local pub when we were sort of 15, 16, I suppose, something like that. And if it had a piano, I'd start playing the piano, and Glenn would have an acoustic guitar, and we'd play sort of Elvis songs or Jerry Lee songs and some blues songs and some Beatles songs. And everybody would say, that's good. And we'd have our friends. And then the landlord would say, well, you come back and do that next week. And then here's a fiver. And then we'd sort of we had about 5 little gigs we do like that, and then more people would come, you know. And then it evolved into Chris Difford came and they started writing songs, and it became much more of a thing. But we could all, I mean, Glenn Tilbrook is a great rock and roll boogie woogie. Mm-hmm. He plays that music great, you know. He's a very good guitar player, but he can play that. He could do a very convincing B.B. King style boogie guitar. I mean, there B.B. King is a great boogie woogie guitar player. You know, he would.
Because it's funny, the word boogie to us because conjures up visions of status quo and pub rock, doesn't it?
Boogie, well, no. Or of course Michael Jackson, and attributing the blame to the boogie, which is what he did. they didn't have the woogie was left out. It's like the blues has a huge or jazz. Once you try and define music, I mean, I'll just name drop again. Ray Charles did say this to me. Once you define music with words, you'll trip over yourself. Because I was saying something about, are you a blues pianist? You know, it's like jazz. It covers all this stuff. You know, you get some people say, oh, boogie woogie isn't jazz, of course. But I mean, it's fast improvisational music based on the blues. So if that's not jazz, I don't know what is. But it's like, but it doesn't sound anything like. If you listen to sort of a weather report or something like that, you know.
Well, so, that's the thing. There's so many of those American musical genres that we know, which are all basically just 12 bar with different rhythm and instrumentation. And you change instrumentation and the rhythm and it becomes an entirely different genre.
Because I was going to ask, what about ragtime? Where does that fit in on this?
Well, that's ragged time, you see, that comes from. And ragged time is that's what it's meant to be. But that was an early form of, and it's quite a sophisticated form, a popular music. And bearing in mind, in the sort of from the late 19th century and the early 20th century, before people were buying lots of records, lots of people played the piano and they read music. And so you'd sell your latest song, you'd sell the sheet music. And there were more pianos than there were cars. People had pianos, you know, even relatively poor people had pianos in their homes and in the pubs everywhere, you know, and people could read music. And so that's the way popular songs spread around. And ragtime was a great way of doing that. It's a new dance. That then evolved into the Harlem Stride piano, which is a slightly different thing, which is that that's really, you can hear hip hop in Harlem Stride piano. That the rhythms, ragtime was quite nice, but it didn't quite have the same, it was based on ragged time, but the stride piano really was syncopated. And that kind of is quite, people like Willie the Lion Smith and Fats Waller, that's quite an exciting sort of form of fast jazz music.
Because ragtime was basically, I remember everyone at school learning The Entertainer when the Sting came out.
Yeah. That's right. And that
ragtime was to us.
Yeah, a popular film is good for that sort of thing and for spreading the music like that. Yeah, that music was all right. I never learned that music because it didn't really boogie, whereas the stride piano that just followed that, then it kind of got going. I think people took the ragtime and then they moved it into something, into a kind of a more percussive styling. But the important thing to remember about the boogie is it's not, you know, when you listen to Lightnin' Hopkins, really, it's 9 bars here. You know, or Lowell Fulton, they're not 12. I wouldn't get locked into 12 bars.
Well, it's because it's with the thing with blues when it was solo performers. Again, that's the right. It's like also whether it's in 3, whether it's in 4, and you're right. And the bar structure is completely random, isn't it? It's just whatever the bloke wants. It's like Syd Barrett. It's basically all about whatever the vocals doing.
Exactly. I backed Willie Dixon, who of course wrote, you know, I Just Want to Make Love to You. You know, he was one of the greatest blues writers of all time. And
sorry,
I was working
Wang
with him
Dang
with
Doodle.
I just want to make a picture of Wang Dang Doodle.
I'm going to pitch a Wang Dang Doodle all night long.
I mean, you are.
Which is quite frightening. And he said, I was with a band of very sophisticated musicians, and they got completely confused because they said, right, how many bars is it before we go to the four chord then? He said, it's when I lift my hand up. They said, well, how many bars is that? He said, well, it's when I lift my hand up. So it's like that's what you've got to do with the blues. Yeah. You've got to, you know, it's a feel thing. You know, you've got to sort of watch the main bloke.
I love that old school playing. We were talking the other day to Stephen Van Zandt, and there's that brilliant bit of footage where you know, they're jamming on stage with Bruce Springsteen. He just holds his hand up with four fingers like this, and the whole band go to the four chord. And it's like, wow, you know, I grew up in the 80s. We never did things like that. You know,
yeah, the four chord. We never even knew there was a four chord. We only had the one.
What do you hold up for a major seven?
Latin musicians are the kings for that, aren't they? Where you basically have, they'll start an evening and there's just a set of cues. And that's, you know, rather than even music, it's just like, that's half time. That means go double time. That means go to three. And they'll just play all night based on hand signals. So,
yeah, no, but I've seen that. I mean, the old trad jazzes in the pubs used to do that. Tapping the tops of their head meant one thing, go back to the top. And it was a bit like the Tic Tac men at the dog tracks, yes. You know, where it was all these symbols, but you weren't quite sure what they meant. And I turned up club once and sat in with Dr. John in Texas, and he was like putting two fingers up, and I thought, what's that about then? He's like telling me sort of fuck off sort of thing, but he wasn't. He was telling me the key, it was the key of D, because it was the sharps and the flats where he's put his hands up.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's for one flat, and it was flats were down and sharps were up, so that was how you knew what the key was.
No, yeah.
E flat. Yeah.
Jules, we have to get back to your life a bit. You have these beautiful sort of naughty incidents that happen occasionally in your life, which spur you on to the next great success. And I did read about you upsetting one of the teachers at school by damaging his Triumph Herald and getting expelled. Is that true?
Well, I've got nothing. But not quite. There have been a lot of, you know, when I was talking earlier about playing in pubs with Glenn Tilbrook and that, when we first did that, I think I hadn't been going to school much anyway, and it gave us both an idea that we thought, well, hang on, we're getting paid to go and play music in a pub, in pubs. we can do this. We were sort of overly confident, thinking, oh, this is all going to be all right. Probably like yourself, you thought, you imagine you're going to be a pop star, and then you are. But when you look back, you can't believe that it worked out, that it really was true, because lots of people imagine it, but it doesn't. They don't actually become that, if you see what I mean. So we had this sort of rather maybe blind confidence. And so I wasn't really bothered with the school thing. And so I hadn't been there, and they kept saying, if you don't come in, we're going to chuck you out, which I thought, well, that seems pretty good to me. I mean, I can't, you know, I've thank you for everything, but I've had enough. And then I think we were standing around the back somewhere enjoying cigars and cognac after our lunch, and somebody's rolled a sixpence under the teacher's car by mistake. And they said, oh, we can't reach the money. We need the money to get whatever it was. And so I explained that if you bounce, which is true, you know, for instance, a car is blocking your exit, you can, if there's two of you, if you bounce the car up and down after a while, you can bounce the car away to move it out of the way. Nowadays, it's harder because all the cars have alarms and things like that, and it's a bit more difficult, and probably the airbags go off and all of that. But in those days, it was much, and cars were smaller and lighter and everything. So anyway, we were doing this, and then the poor fellow whose car it was came around the corner and said, what are you doing? And it did look, I could see how it looked bad. I could see that. It didn't look good. That was the poor geography teacher. And that was the end of it. They said, well, we've done all we can for you. Get out.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And was it just straight to music? Is that kind of...
Yeah, we played in the pubs. I tried a couple of other jobs. No, I did. We played in the pubs, and then again, it was fortunate because early on we were sort of off touring. I think in 77, it must have been 76. So we had various record deals, and then they got rid of us because it didn't work out. But somehow we managed to, we'd get another record deal, and that would give us another little bit of money to carry on to the next thing, you know, and we'd be playing in, I don't know, supporting Curved Air in Leicester University or whatever. But then one way or another, we carried on and sort of and managed to sort of just carry on. I think it's amazing if you can carry on, really, you know. I think it's much harder now for people, not just with the pandemic, if you were a young musician, but generally, because I think it's just much harder. You can't just bowl into places and turn up and play much, you know. I think that's harder.
I know Glenn and Chris get all the credit for writing the songs, which they obviously did. I don't know how much you contributed, but your personality and even how you are now, you know, there's a sort of there's a kind of whimsy of nostalgia about what you do and how you present yourself that's funny, that's very, very British. And so were Chris and Glenn's songs. How did that sort of little world get created by you guys?
I think that's right. I think it was a very, I think we were from the same part of, like you, except a different part of London. So I suppose that was part of it. And we had the same shared sense of humour. We did have a great laugh. And I mean, Glenn and Chris wrote most songs. I wrote one or two of them, but it was really most of it was their work. And they were great at it. And we enjoyed touring because we had a nice time. We'd go out and we'd see the world. It was like you know, the best way to see the world, because our manager Miles, we were one of the first lot to be taken out to America, you know, traveling around in the back of a van or whatever. But it was the most exciting thing you could do at age, you know, 19 or 20. It's an amazing thing to be able to enjoy. And I think we liked one another's company. And I think the humor, I think, was very important. And we used to see some bands that really, you know, we'd be on tour with some bands, and they obviously really didn't like one another at all. And we didn't really understand that. You know, that was a bit mystified, but how you could face, or why you would bother going on tour with people you didn't really like. I suppose if you can't pay a load of money, you put up with it. But
I go on holiday with my family. What do you mean?
There's two types of bands, though, aren't there? There's the bands that hate each other, where that feeds the creativity and creates some wonderful angst-driven masterpiece. And then there's the rest of us who just get, like to be on the road with people we like.
Exactly, and try and have quite a nice time, really, you know. And I think that it was the shared humour. I think also if you're young and you're experiencing the same things together, that sort of travelling and excitement and meeting people and coming into a world that you sort of dreamed of existed somewhere else, but then you become part of it. It's great to do that if you're sharing it with some like-minded folk. You know, I think that's part of the pleasure of it. That we were all very different elements. You know, I was a boogieist and loved, you know, all the soul and blues music and all that, as it was called back then. And Chris Difford was great and was like the love of Velvet Underground and all of this sort of thing. And Glenn Talbot was like was an amazing guitar player. I mean, it's when we first started, who had taken on board Jimi Hendrix and the blues and everything. You know, it was like he was really quite an extraordinary thing. So they were all, we all shared we all liked the other stuff as well. It wasn't like we only liked this and didn't like that. And I think it was mixing those things together which helped inform what we did live. And it's probably learning early on how to get a crowd going that really helped us and informed, you know, our live performances, because you realize, you know, you sort of develop that as you get older, as you know yourself. That's what you do. You kind of figure out how to play a crowd and communicate the music the best.
How did you end up playing on Wayne County's Fuck Off, which I have to say is absolutely a brilliant record, even as that title.
It is one of the great records, I have to say. I was very honored to play on that. He rang me.
Is it pre-Squeeze, Jules?
It was. I was in Squeeze, it was 1976. I think it came out in 77. But he was recording a record. Squeeze hadn't put a record out yet. And Wayne County rang and said, "I'm doing a record. Could you come and play on my play on a track?" And he was recording at Marquee Studios. He's then since had a change and became Jane County. But he was fantastic then, and as she is now. He said, put the piano on this. It's kind of burlesque. I haven't put the words on it yet. I said, "All right, thanks very much." So I put this blues piano on this sort of style. He said, "Oh, thanks very much." I said, "Look," I think his manager was there and said, "Oh, you get 23 quid as your session fee." And I'd never had a session fee before. I said, "Oh, thanks. That's really great." I said, "But the thing that would mean more to me than the money, actually, although thanks very much, I'll have the money. But the thing that would really mean a lot to me is I've never actually been on an actual record before. So could you make sure you send me one? It just means so much to me to actually get the finished record." So they got my address, said, "Sure, yeah." And I was living with my mum and dad at the time. And they said, record came through the post. And when we'd recorded, there were no lyrics. So I didn't, I just played on the thing. And I got it. And my mum was there with my aunt and some friends of theirs, and they're all having tea. And I said, "Here's the record I've played on." And I didn't even look at the title. And they said, "Oh, it's Listen, Everybody. Look, shush, shush, here. We're putting, this is his first record he's played on. Listen to this. What is it?" On it goes. Anyway, and there's a piano intro, and they all beam because it goes, "I better work. I better get up with it on a piano. That's great." And then in comes Wayne with the first line. "You don't want to fuck me, baby, 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 fuck off." Anyway, it went on like that. And then at the end, it has the traditional punk reprise where it finishes. And then they go, one, two, three, four. And then the tempo doubles up. And they all just scream, "Fuck off, fuck off, fuck off" at the end of it. And it sort of sounds like everything's exploding. Anyway, at the end of it, my mother looked at one. She said, "Well, isn't that lovely? Hasn't he done lovely?" Yeah. And they said, "Oh, isn't that lovely piano on that?" Yeah. Nobody referred to the lyrics or anything like that. They just said,
nice foot-tapping beat.
Yeah, exactly. And then I did take my mother to see Wayne County because I was going to sit in with him, but then they didn't have a piano at somewhere like, I can't remember, one of those sort of gigs where the punks wasn't a roundhouse, somewhere like that. Yeah, no, it was somewhere bigger than that. It was a sort of a multi, there was a lot of people on the bill. Anyway, we went in and it was rather good because when he came on, everybody chanted "fuck off," but it wasn't because they wanted him to. It was because they wanted his hit. But it's quite funny when you come on the whole thing, like it was the best thing they could have shouted.
Anyone going to YouTube to listen to that, make sure your aunt and mother aren't having tea in the same room. But there is a brilliant guitar on that, Greg Van Cook.
Yes, I looked him up. That's right.
What great guitarist. Is he still around, do we know?
Good question. There was a band, was the Electric Chairs. I was an honorary Electric Chair. And they were great. No, really good band. And because I think they were from New York, I think. And that's so they had a sort of certain edge. And they came out of that. It was that beginning of punk.
DBGBs.
New York Dolls sort of things and all of that, yeah.
Why did you leave? squeeze, Jules?
Well, I think I loved it. You know, I mean, I think it's great. I mean, I still enjoy their company. And Chris Difford, of course, still tours with me. I mean, if we go to just jump to the future, Chris Difford still comes out with me sometimes. Glenn Tilbrook still goes out, and Chris goes out with playing with him. But then once I think I'm back in the sort of my early 80s, I thought, well, really, I want to do my own thing. And I think you have to put your hand up, do your own thing if you want to do it. So I then did The Millionaires, and it wasn't, you know, I hadn't really thought it through. The good bit was I met Pino Palladino. Who
I was going to say, yes, absolutely. Yeah. With the Welsh bass player. He's my Macbeth. He can only be referred to as the Welsh bass player.
You're not allowed to say that in this podcast. You'll have to spin around and holding your nose now.
Exactly. But we brought him up from Wales. He was introduced to me by a saxophone player called Mike Pace, who sadly passed away the other day. But Pino's great. I was talking to him the other day. But anyway, but I left Squeeze first because I wanted to do my own thing. And much as I love them, you know, I think in music, you have to be driven by the music that you want to play, really. And then I did the Tube for a bit. That came up.
We can't pass on the Tube, which was just the absolute most fun thing in the world to do. It was the best show ever. That was our Ready Steady Go, wasn't it, for the Aces?
I mean, I also mention Paula, because Paula, yeah. Wow, what she invented that sardonic interview, didn't she? Irony in her voice. I mean, there would be no style of presenting, really. You and her set the tone forever, really.
I think what she did, actually, which was really, she thought the world of you, by the way. She really liked you. I should mention that.
Oh, I loved her too.
I think what she did, which was really great, which she did invent at the time on the television in music, it was very earnest, everything, and rather serious. There's a program, I think, called the Oxford Road Show, or there was the Old Grey Whistle Test. And they were great shows, but they were quite serious and quite earnest in their approach. And Paula, a little bit like the attitude of the blues, actually, that's quite an important thing. Like the attitude of the blues, she couldn't care less what you thought of her. It's just, this is what I'm doing. You can like it or you can dislike it, but I couldn't care less. This is me. And I think it was very interesting to have that sort of attitude, because it hadn't been, and it was also spontaneous. It wasn't written down or planned. So I think that it started that, and it hadn't. We hadn't seen that before in music television, because it hadn't been that before. It had either been super nicey or very earnesty and seriously, and it hadn't had that. I couldn't care less what you think of me. I'm going to ask you about sex, which is a completely different sort of angle. But that's what a lot of the music was about. So why not?
A cultural point I'd like to bring up. One thing I used to love whenever I was doing the Tube was I'd run around the front where the audience were coming in under that tunnel, because there were two guys who used to go around and sell this. It was like a fanzine stuck to, you know, just stapled together, photocopied comic, which is the funniest, filthiest thing you'd ever seen. It was just a fanzine called Viz.
That's right.
And it's literally that's where Viz was born, right? It was basically selling it to the audience of the Tube.
That's right. That's where they first started. Exactly. Yeah. And he still lives like that. That's right. But who did you come on there when you came on?
I did it with Stephen Duffy, with Ice House, with Womack and Womack. That was a legendary one, where we were doing Soul Man, and Jimmy Nail got up to sing with us and said, "These people are soul people."
Yes.
In fact, really, the first time I did it, because that was the funny thing, you were always trying out new presenters, some of whom worked, a lot of whom didn't. And when I did it with Ice House, we were introduced by this incredibly enthusiastic elfin character called Nick Laird Clues, who wasn't lasted very long, who came back with us on the train. We got talking. He asked me to come and play for his band Dream Academy. And that's how I got to know David Gilmour.
There you are. Tube.
Yeah.
So you
there you are.
There you are. Yeah. So thank you.
And just to describe what it was to do it, you had to go up to Newcastle, which was the only, you know, there weren't many reasons to go to Newcastle to play, apart from playing the brilliant City Hall. But you found yourself in Newcastle with a load of other Geordies, Jeff Womfer, who was one of the main directors.
He was a very funny fellow, great.
And who was the other?
Gavin. And Andrea Womfer and Malcolm Gary, who was the producer.
Malcolm, of course.
Who's still around. In fact, I'm going to do a show with a prostate cancer charity show at the Royal Albert Hall with Malcolm. So he's still sort of, you know, working away and doing stuff. I think the other thing was, because everybody used to have to go up the night before, it was such a long way, you couldn't go up that day, you know, but it meant that everybody was around enjoying themselves the night before. The walls of the Gosforth Park Hotel could probably bear witness to many frissons, events and little heartbreaks.
But and also you could kind of tell how what the record company thought of you, judging by whether you got the train or were flown.
That's right.
We flew.
Yeah. I did half an hour. I did it in a van once.
But, you know, there would be no Chris Evans if it wasn't for the Tube, yeah. For example. That whole vibe was taken completely from the Tube. And also, with what was going on at that time was what we called then alternative comedy. And a lot of those guys were starting on your show as well, weren't they? Like Vic Reeves, I think.
That's right. Well, that we embrace them. I mean, Vic Reeves was one I'm doing a podcast with, but also the people, you know, French and Saunders and Edmondson and Rick Mayall and Robbie Coltrane, all those people who are doing the comic strip, because it was interesting because, again, it was that we're doing something different. And it was a bit like the sort of inmates had taken over the asylum for a while, and it was kind of great, and you could do what you wanted. And I think there was a time. Maybe it's coming back with the internet. You can do what you want on the internet, sort of thing, you know. But there was a time in television where, just for a moment, where you could just come up with an idea, sketch it out on the back of a matchbox, and then somebody would give you £500,000 to go and make it. And nowadays, you can't do that. It's like there's, you know, you have to wade through endless sort of commissioners and forms and proposals and work out everything you're going to do in advance, rather than just say, we've got a vague idea of doing this, can we just go off with a film crew and do it? And I think that was very much that time. And that's what the comic strip was sort of about, although they thought, you know, they wrote their films very carefully, but it was based on they just have a good idea and then there's somebody giving them money to go and do it.
But you're still incredibly constrained by sort of language and stuff. I remember you had a sort of shocking, Simon Le Bon said something shocking when he was introducing BAD, I think. And it wasn't even that bad what he said, but there was a huge chastisement.
We used to get, there was endless little things. And I think, there was an incident I seem to remember where we thought it was amusing, where you had a little hamster appearing. And we said it was Michael Jackson's hamster and he was called William. And we were going to have a competition to see if anybody could guess the weight of the hamster. And you had to put on a postcard, guess the weight of Michael Jackson's Willie. And we thought that was funny, but it just really, it was like there was a thousand, you know, it was such a babyish joke, really, you know, from like sort of 10-year-old or two. But it was a lot of, you know, complaints about that and so forth. But there we are. That's, you know, that was the 80s for you.
But of course, then you got in trouble for swearing as well, didn't you? What did you say?
Well, I had just an inadvertent slip of the tongue. I mean, I was tired, actually. I think I'd been inadvertently overserved at the Gosford Park Hotel the evening before. It was on a little trailer for the show saying, be there or be a completely ungroovy fucker. And I don't know why I said that. It just came out. I don't know why. And there wouldn't have been a problem with it. I mean, nowadays people say all that sort of thing on the television. Yeah. But there was a huge outcry at the time. Mary Whitehouse wrote and complained. And I wrote back to apologising. I actually agreed with it. It was an inadvertent slip of the tongue and you didn't. And in fact, she was right. And it's like, you look now, there's endless swearings on the television all the time. You know, I mean, and I would have put a stop to it. So I think she was right and I was wrong.
Yeah, no, we now have an 8 a.m. watershed, don't we?
Yeah, I think that's right. Exactly. But,
you know, it was an interesting channel, Channel 4, when it started, because I seem to remember when it first started that it was going to be, and I think this was the term, a minorities channel. And then a few things happened mostly it was the 80s and groovy music happening and MTV or whatever. But then they decided to make it a youth channel. That was the sort of premise on which it sold itself, Channel 4. But of course, they struggled with that a bit, didn't they? You know.
Yeah, I think the first, the alternative, when it started, I think there were all these people like Jeremy Isaacs and Richard Attenborough were involved with it. And they were guiding it. The idea was it would give a platform to people that didn't have a voice elsewhere, which was quite an interesting take on things. And so allow people like the comic strip to make films where they wouldn't have been able to make them before. And they did. They financed really great films. And so but then they kind of took on a different idea. They were just trying to be a ratings winner like everybody else in the end. And so, yeah, it sort of changed. But it was a good idea. But like lots of things, you know, they you know, things come and go. But but at that particular time, it was great because they had their own take on things, you know. And it was an alternative to what you could see at the time.
And was it your swearing that shut the show down in the end, Jules?
I can't remember. I think it had run its course because it had been very spontaneous, and it had been it was a great fun, of course, but it was then they tried to sort of we did a show, and that one, this new director came up, and he was trying to say, he was trying to make spontaneity happen, and you can't do that. It needs to have, you know, you can't enforce that. You can't be outrageous every week, you know. And it just, I think it had run its course, but it was great while it had gone on. But I think it had naturally run its course by the end. It went on for a little bit after I'd sort of went home, and then it was very honoured because I think they had different people step in for me. Peter Cook was one, Dame Edna was another. So they had the best people were depping for me.
Very flattering to have that calibre.
Really couldn't have been better. Exactly. Yeah. But it was really sort of unbelievable. But then by the end of it, Squeeze had reformed, because also by that time I'd left Squeeze. Squeeze had split up. They'd reformed, and then we got together and toured for about 3 years and did two or three records, and I think had another hit somewhere along the line. Anyway, but by the end of that, then I was getting, I was doing a film somewhere about music where was I doing a film with music in Memphis or something? And I had a lot of gigs of my own. And so basically myself and Gilson, the drummer, I said, well, I can't do it. I'm afraid I was only so. And I did a music program in New York after about 3 years. I said, I'm sorry, I can't do this anymore. So by the end of the 80s, that was it. So Squeeze sort of split up. I left them, they split up. Then we got back together again. Then I had to sort of leave them, but all on good terms. But then my big band started, which was just me and Gilson, the drummer. And I'd say, well, here he is, my big band, ladies and gentlemen. Just one person would come on stage. He was it. But then it evolved literally into a big band of 18 people. And the strange thing was, the more people you had in the band, it seemed the more people would come and see you. So I'm always looking for more people. Maybe you could both join me or just get more and more people.
Sure.
Because obviously you played at, we were privileged to see you playing at David Gilmour's 70th, and Jeff Beck got up and David got up. You played with so many amazing people, Jules.
I mean, that was a strange thing. By having the big band, and then that's what you wouldn't have thought. Then by the 90s, the big band had sort of gone on. And then really the strange thing was then by the early 80s and the first 5 or 6 years of the 90s, we would put these records out and I was selling loads of records, you know, more than I'd ever done before. I mean, it was very strange for an old gentleman like myself.
But you do get amazing guest artists.
With some great guest artists and some interesting sort of collaborations of stuff. So yeah, it was strange. I wouldn't have thought of really having a big band would have worked. It certainly doesn't in a pandemic, but there you are.
And then what was the genesis of Later then, Jules? How did you?
So I suppose Later first came out after the Tube had finished. I'd done this program in America. There was a fellow who ran BBC Two called Michael Jackson, and he wanted to do a music program. I went to have dinner with him, and he booked the table. At the Caprice restaurant, and I went to meet him, and I said, I'm meeting Michael Jackson, and the tension in the room, you could tell all the waiters, they had the best table. And when this fellow arrived, and he was a great fellow, I mean, he was a really sort of, he was a very important and clear thinking sort of executive, but his name was Michael Jackson. So they got the wrong idea, and that must have happened to him quite a lot. So you could see them all sort of, obviously they didn't say anything, but they were just slightly, when it was not Michael Jackson. But he then with myself and with Mark Cooper, Janet Fraser-Cook, who directs it, sort of worked out that you just wanted to take something back to the basic idea and try and have a mix of music and to be a home where there wasn't, where other things didn't have a home, like folk or blues or world music or whatever, and reggae music and all that, as well as having mainstream people and as well as having new people and as well as having great legends. So that was the sort of the idea, and you'd have it in one room and on it would go.
Can I tell you, I have a terrible fear on Later now, Jules, which is that ever since I've done, I don't know, for anyone who knows, when the show starts, all the bands are playing a groove together, right? That's when it comes up. Now, every time I've done Later, you've always asked me to start it, Jules, right? You've gone, all right, guy, take it away. So I'm now terrified when I do Later that if you don't ask me, then I've done something wrong. But well, I'm not your favourite anymore.
But because it's a last minute thing, and of course we rather stop doing that now. But because it was such a last minute thing, the sort of groove at the front, I would just look around the room for somebody I knew who could be relied upon, who would understand. Because a lot of people, if they were sometimes the visiting Americans, wouldn't quite understand what was required. But if somebody I knew was in the room, it was a really good musician that would understand what the thing was, that was the answer. Always looking around, and I was always a bit disappointed when you weren't playing with somebody on the show.
Jules, you played on that show, obviously, but over the years with so many people. I mean, I'm wondering who your all-time hero was that you suddenly sat down and got a chance to groove with.
Probably Guy. And then after that, I suppose, no, I mean, it is great. You have to pinch yourself to think you know, because you're sitting next to people. If there are people you've grown up with, that's really great, who are then sort of well-known artists. But if there's somebody who was a great artist when you were a child that you liked, you have to sort of pinch yourself, you know. I mean, I remember playing with Paul McCartney and thinking, I can't believe this. You know, yeah. I grew up sort of worshipping the Beatles, and there I am playing Lady Madonna with him. And he showed me exactly the fingering as well, which is slightly different to what I thought it was. You know, so things like that, I think it was really good. I remember B.B. King coming on and seeing B.B. King, his neck started to rock in rhythm and his foot started to go when we were doing some boogie. And I thought that was a great moment, because not only was it an exciting moment of playing, but I could see that the way I was and he said it to me before, he said, you played like people used to play a long time ago. And I said, oh, thanks. He meant it in the best possible way. Yeah. And I could see it got him going.
More giddy.
By his physical reaction. So that was good, you know.
Amazing. I mean, of course, Dr. John as well, I would have thought, isn't it? Yeah.
Dr. John was really great, and there's a YouTube bit actually of us on American television show which we did, which I was looking at the other day. And you forget this, a strange thing, you do something, you know, a TV show at the time might go out and have sort of, I don't know, a million viewers or whatever it is, or half a million viewers, but not like sort of the big rating show sort of thing. But then after the event, something appears on YouTube and it keeps building up, and this thing had like sort of 10 million views. Unbelievable. I mean, you thought, hang on a minute, what's happened here?
I've seen it. It's you doing a dual boogie with Dr. John, isn't it?
Dressed yeah, we have top hats on. I'm not sure. I think the top hats was my idea. I'm not quite sure why it was. I think it's because on his record Gumbo, he had a top hat or something. Yeah, yeah. I was trying to think what that was, but I made us have that.
I mean, the sad thing is some of those clips now, when you watch later, you know, on replay, you know, sometimes they're the last time any of these guys appeared on TV, they've gone.
That's a sad thing. The positive thing, though, that is, it's great to have captured people before they go. That's right. There's one of Chris Barber the other day, one Johnny Cash, you know, people. But then also you get the first time people are on television as well. So, you know, like Amy Winehouse, you get a lot of the first time she was appeared and things like that. You know, so it's, you get both ends of it, you know, with the people that are great.
We never got a chance to talk about your train set, which I know is your main.
Well, I'm happy to do. We can do a whole separate.
And I really loved what you posted broadcast the other day of the Blue Peter clip of the Reverend doing the sound effects of a train.
Oh, the first beatboxer.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. It was when he was going along the tracks. It was so. I thought, what a great bloke. Absolutely nothing like this I've seen, you know, really great.
They don't make TV like that anymore, and they don't make TV like yours anymore, Jules. Oh, no. You know, that's such a pro, isn't it, to say that sort of you. Thank you so much for being on here. The music business owes you so much.
Yes, on behalf of a grateful nation.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes, and we didn't even mention the other fact that he's your deputy lieutenant of Kent.
Yes,
lieutenant of America.
Sorry, deputy lieutenant of Kent. That were you in charge of the variants or?
No, but if there's an invasion or something like that, you know, we've been in charge of the beacons, and of course, representing her dear Majesty when she can't be there in person.
Oh, right.
Anyway, I've got to fly off because I've got to go and see Nitin now. But it's marvellous to see you both, and marvellous to hear you both. A privilege and honour to be on this very notable podcast, and I can't wait to hear it. And I shall be following you on Instagram to see when it appears.
That was such fun.
Great fun.
Could go on forever. Could go forever.
Yeah, he's got such a diverse career, hasn't he? You know,
yeah, but now I want to know who's a secret boogie-woogie player, because that's not one thing he knows about everyone.
Yeah,
they wouldn't confess elsewhere.
Jules has managed to have a great sense of humour that he's carried through as well, and so we can all laugh along at ourselves on TV.
Exactly. Thanks for listening, and please leave your lovely comments, reviews, and please subscribe, and thank you to Ben, our producer.
Oh, yes, and thank you to you for all of those wonderful things you do for us, and listen especially. And we will see you, or you'll hear us, this time next week.
So it's good night from him.
And it's good night from all of us.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.